Hi folks, how are you? I hope you had a great weekend. Did it involve going to the cinema? Did you see anything? Maybe you watched some stuff at home. We'd love to know what you watch. In fact, how's about dropping us an email, info@edithbowman.com. Let us know what you've seen, what you've loved, whether it be at the theatre, theatrical release at the cinema or on streaming. We'd love to know. Our latest guest on soundtracking is composer Martin Phipps. Now, amongst Martin's credits are Ridley Scott's Napoleon and 4 seasons of The Crown. I've been lucky enough to chat to Martin because I thoroughly enjoyed hosting Netflix's official podcast to accompany The Crown, where we delve into the most intricate details of the show, both in front of the camera and behind the camera. So if you haven't listened to it already, then you can find it on all your usual podcast providers. It's called The Crown, the official podcast. And Martin's work is so important to the story and the narrative and the emotion and the drama that you feel in the show. He joined The Crown in season 3, which follows the life and early reign of Queen Elizabeth, just in case you didn't know. And we'll begin with his cue from that season, Princess.
I'm trying to think the last time I saw you. I think it was Napoleon briefly, wasn't it? Kind of from afar almost in a way.
Yeah. I didn't sadly get a chance to chat to you that
evening. I know.
I did a thing with Sarah on The Crown. We did that podcast, didn't we?
Yeah, that was great fun. It's really nice to have both those worlds to be able to talk about that. Is it weird actually that it's all that's kind of done? Because I imagine like The Crown's been such an ever-present part of your world for 10 years, maybe?
Like a full-time job for, 5 years. 5 years.
5 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was a kind of rolling cycle of work that came back. And normally I'm used to sort of moving from one project to another. But it was great. You know, what a thing to be part of.
I was listening to a couple of other podcasts that you were on. And the early chat that we had for The Crown podcast back for season 3, I think, was the original chat that we had. For a creative as well, the opportunities that it must have given you on so many levels for something that's chronologically updating as it goes through, you know, as it gets closer and closer to kind of current times, it's going through periods. Was that something that you had to consider for the score kind of going through, of almost kind of modernising things in a way? Or was that never part of a conversation?
I mean, when I joined, because I joined in season 3 and I didn't do the first 2 seasons. And so already there was a big jump. You know, they changed cast every 2 seasons and already there was a big jump there. That's part of the reason I was brought in, I think, to try and, you know, to change the tone of the music and move it a little bit more up to date. But to be honest, when I was starting season 3, all I was thinking about was trying to make season 3 work and not really thinking about what was to come, or even if I was going to be doing what was to come. But those conversations did arise later on, definitely, as we moved into 5 and 6. So really the conversations that we had when I joined in season 3 with Peter Morgan, who's the showrunner, he kept referring to this idea of suppressed power. He wanted the establishment, the feeling of the royal family is this incredibly powerful family, although it seems quite sort of benign on the surface. But actually underneath it and the machine and the politics and its connection with Westminster, there was this, as I say, this bubbling power underneath. And he wanted that represented in the music. He wanted a sense that a strength and a might underneath the surface in the music. So the music was quite muted, but very big, and just felt like it was coming at us from underneath. That's very much how he wanted it represented in the music. And we tried early on to sort of incorporate that. And so it wasn't about being very loud and bombastic. It wasn't about being incredibly in your face and lots of big fanfares and loud brass. And it was much more about the restrained power of what we were trying to represent.
I think that that's the clever thing that the show did as well. And also those moments where they highlighted things outside of that kind of core royal family unit. You know, for example, I thought it was just really wonderful the way that they gave Mohammed Al-Fayed, you know, a kind of a history, giving him a backstory and telling us a little bit about that background. And that for you, I imagine, as a composer, and giving you that environment of Egypt you know, his upbringing, an opportunity to kind of explore what works with that sonically as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was ironically that the hardest episodes were often when we stepped outside the world and outside the family. And I think it was always where everybody struggled the most. And Peter Morgan and his writers, that you know, they found it the toughest, but often they were the most, ended up being the most rewarding episodes. And and certainly for me to score, I really enjoyed that. And it was such a clever conceit, the idea of looking at the whole royal family from the position of an outsider and somebody who desperately wanted to be in but was pushed out. That was, again, really interesting to score. We sort of came up in seasons 5 and 6 with this drum sound that I'd sampled from a recording of the recording of his wedding, you know, for the show. They did his wedding as all this backstory of Mohammed Al-Fayed. And I took a little piece of the live percussion that they recorded on the day and sort of messed around with it and looped it. And it became this kind of insistent beat in the back of Mohammed Al-Fayed's head, him sort of driving him forward, trying to, you know, his ambition, his desperate desire to be accepted, and ultimately pushing his son into that car on that fateful night. Kind of, I mean, that's unfair, but there is a truth there too, I think. Yeah. That's what we were trying to look at. And then one of the other episodes that, you know, just to digress a little bit, the, you know, again, talking about going outside the world of the crown, of the family, one of the toughest episodes to do was when Michael Fagin broke the story of him breaking into the palace, Queen's bed at the, you know, she woke up in the morning, and it was such a tricky episode to do because we moved into a completely different world. Kind of deprived 80s doll cues and then try to match that with, you know, marry that, and those two worlds collide. But it's actually one of my favourite episodes in the end. I love that one.
Yeah, it's a great episode. But that's the tricky thing, isn't it? That you've got to give these individual episodes their identity, but there has to be connective tissue between the rest of the show. That's not an easy ask, but it's your job.
Exactly. If I've got one job. So, yeah, the connective tissue is really important. And I was basically working with Peter Morgan and the directors, and they wouldn't say, this is what we need to be the connective tissue. Yes, that's my job to try and find that. But when I sort of landed on something that they liked, they would go, yes, this is a sort of core part of the sound. The solo French horn being kind of perfect example. I mean, overall, the idea, and something Peter was very into, was being very singular, being very clear in the voice, not cluttering it up with music up with too much stuff. So he loved this sort of solo voice idea, and the French horn really captured the sort of it really did a clever thing of giving us that sort of suppressed power feel, that colonial heritage, the weight of the office, but then also there's a tenderness and a sort of almost solo voice feel to it, and the loneliness of the office of the Queen and those in that power, and the prime ministers too.
I was just going to say another episode I was thinking about that I really enjoyed, really clever, is the Ritz one. I mean, that whole relationship of Margaret and Elizabeth is just a beauty. You could have had a whole show about those two.
Yeah.
And also seeing those different actors kind of play with that relationship as well. And, you know, finishing with Leslie and Imelda. And that lovely flashback moment you have to that night. You know, and that's another way that you've got to marry that relationship of the music, you know, with the diegetic music that's in there on that night, with kind of what you're then surrounding the rest of the episode with as well.
Right. And the whole sisters idea was ran right through all the seasons I worked on, was very strong. We had a cue called Sisters, and it kept coming back, and that was one of our sort of strong themes. And yes, and it sort of culminated in that night. And I mean, what was done for talking about the recording, the source, the diegetic music, the music that's in the scene, the recorded in the club at the Ritz, was just so brilliantly done. I mean, that was Sarah Bridge and her team doing that. And yes, and I worked around that, but it was, you know, that filled its own space. And the score always kept a very different space to the music, to either the needle drop stuff, you know, when they brought tracks into the episodes, or stuff that was being played in the scenes. The score always had and I really appreciated this, it was always given a space very much on its own. So you sort of really noticed when it was score and when it was other things.
You know, even though that you say that you came on in season three, there has been obviously introduction to new characters throughout the four seasons that you've worked on.
Right.
You know, whether that be William and Kate and Harry and loads of other characters, really, you know, in terms of what they are bringing to the show and what you have to provide them with regards to you know, score for that.
Yes, I mean, absolutely, that was a sort of strong part of season six, was something for William, and it kind of came out of what we have for Diana, which made sense, obviously. Diana's theme was just this very simple arpeggiated harp. I mean, really delicate, really vulnerable, but elegant, I hope. And touching and sort of charged with emotion. William's theme sort of came out of that sort of sound, that very simple plucked string sound. Again, very minimal, very, very intimate. Hopefully bringing your audience right in an intimate way with these very hugely famous characters. And that's, what we're trying to do.
I hadn't really thought about that in terms of the music of Diana that you created, which you did create, spawning in the same way as, you know, she's his mother. Yes. Her music is the musical mother of the music that's such a lovely,
good,
really emotional. God, makes me want to cry, to be honest. That's a beautiful, you know, I think that's the thing kind of where music is so powerful, is that on surface level of us just enjoying it and being in the moment, listening to it, watching it. Yeah. It's affecting us without us even realizing.
Right, without any need for explanation at all.
But yeah.
Then when you get into the sort of the ideas behind it, it's also interesting, isn't it?
Of those kind of, you know, the conversations that you then go on to have with Peter and the directors and stuff are in the script. How much? I mean, I've been lucky enough from being part of the Crime podcast to get those scripts and also just see the change in the scripts from, you know, you get a draft of scripts through and then suddenly it's changed. And also the episodes as you see them edited.
Yeah.
I said it was one of my favorite things of being part of that project was just getting to see that process of how things change and how things. So you imagine, you know, for you as well, in terms of that constant shift until stuff's locked.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So my process on The Crown was an unusual one in terms of how I would normally work on a project. I'd get together with Peter at the beginning of the, you know, really just even before they start filming the episodes with the scripts, and we just chat about it. We play some stuff I'd already written. We play some other people's stuff. We generally just talk about tone and feel. And then I just go away and write a sort of album's worth of material and throw it at him. And he would go, "Oh, that's awful. I hate that. That's rubbish." "Oh, I really like that track. That's brilliant. It was always one or the other." And then we take the tracks that he liked and I developed those a little bit. And then I just handed them over to the editors. Because as you point out, the episodes change so fast and so radically. If I'd started scoring them to picture early on, I'd have just been chasing my tail. The whole thing would have shifted under me. And
yeah.
And actually they needed the music to work with in the edit. And it's sort of quite a modern way of scoring stuff now, is they have the music in the edit and the editors place it, the directors place it, Peter places it, and goes, "This is the right thing for here." And they shift out lots of different things. And then it sort of evolves organically like that. And that's very satisfying for the soundtrack overall. I think it really sort of feels part of it. It's not stuck on at the last minute.
Yeah.
Everything's really thought about and been considered a lot, each cue. I mean, often, and then I will get the episodes back, but I won't even be aware of how much thought has gone into choosing which piece of music went on which scene. So I was really appreciative of that because it made the overall experience and also just allowed me to write the music rather than be constantly doing revisions and chasing a scene that was being recut or dropped, or, you know, so I'd write a great thing for a big scene and then suddenly it would disappear. And, you know, that's quite disheartening and can sort of slow you down a bit.
I was lucky enough to chat to Emma Corrin a couple of weeks ago about Deadpool, actually. But we talked about The Crown because I just remember this great story. It's so lovely because I did their first ever interview, you know, and it was before anyone had seen them as Diana. And we talked about the roller skate scene the dance scene where she was in reality, it was Cher's Believe that they were singing to, and Ben Karen had to say, "We're gonna have to do it again, Emma, because we don't know if we can use the song," and you were lip syncing for the entire duration of this song. Yeah. You know, it was so many kind of collaborations on this show and so many brilliant directors who, you know, collaborating with Peter on how each of those episodes and those characters and those storylines and those relationships should be kind of explored. Was that a lovely part of it for you with regards to this wonderful pool of creatives that you had the chance to collaborate with?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you just feel like you're part of this huge talent machine of amazing people, and I'm just a cog in it, but it's great to be whirring around with the whole vehicle pushing forward. I mean, just go back to that scene that you were talking about. That was great. I think they ended up with an Elton John track on it. And then we did something score-wise. We we sort of did something really unusual, and we bought a piece of scoring over it about halfway through that dance scene. And she carries on dancing to the Elton John track, but then the Elton John track sort of clashes with the score in this really horrible mashup, which is very much her mental breakdown and kind of feeling of distress at that moment as she has her dance gets crazier and crazier. And then it switches over totally to the score, ending up on the shot of Charles outside, sort of smoking a cigarette. No, Camilla smoking a cigarette, watching Charles leave the night for her house the night before the wedding.
Before the wedding.
To Diana. Yeah. And it's such a chilling moment and so brilliantly done. I mean, that was one of my favourite moments in season four, actually.
Yeah. The final episode, you know, Abe Daldry coming back. I mean, that genius, for anyone who hasn't seen it, spoiler, all the queens are there. Yeah. That was, oh my God, it was so powerful. Do you mind talking a little bit about kind of almost rounding everything up, kind of conversations around that whole idea and sleep, Didi, sleep and all that.
So, I mean, with season six, Peter Morgan was he was keen to kind of feel we were getting full circle on things and that we were coming back. He really wanted to sort of maybe bring in some of the themes from the first two seasons, some of the brilliant stuff done by Rupert Gregson-Williams and Norm Balfe. And we incorporated some of those in that season. And also then he had this idea of Sleep, Dearie, Sleep, which was written into the script and which was, you know, which they shot with a bagpipe player playing. And there's a great scene earlier on where Pipes comes in, she summons Pipes into a room and makes him play it, you know, and he's like, well, this is going to create a terrible din. You don't want this. He says, no, play it to me. And that's a fantastic scene. And then, so to do something with that for the final scene made total sense. And Peter was just like, look, here it is, go and do something with it. Yeah, it's quite a challenge because it's a bagpipe is a very limited instrument. It only plays in one key, really, and was very set in it, in what pitch we had to do it in. You know, it only has a certain number of notes that it can play. So trying to build a track around it was quite tricky. But I think we got there in sort of managing to morph out of it into something familiar from the crown and from the score and then take us right through to the end. And yeah, it's a great last scene, isn't it?
Yeah, it's bawling my eyes out. Wow, it's so good. And then, you know, and then life after the crown, it's kind of back into working on, you know, kind of features and you know, and other projects as well. And one of the first that we were you know, we enjoyed was Napoleon. I mean, what an amazing piece of work that was.
Yeah. Very different experience. Again, just, you know, working with a director, showrunner with such incredible vision and energy and... Yeah, just an eye for something unusual and incredible, you know. Yeah, great to be part of that.
How does Ridley work when it comes to music?
He's much more, I think he's got a much clearer idea of where he wants music to work, kind of what it's going to be, what the role of it's going to be. So it was much more like, you know, these are the sections we want you to score. He wanted a lot of source music in there. But he was also very good at giving me sort of an idea. You know, he talked very well about Napoleon's character, about him not being a, you know, a polished aristocrat, about him being a sort of a little bit of a ruffian in aristocratic terms, that is, anyway. He was from Corsica, and he wanted that represented in the music. And he sort of talked about, yeah, the sort of shepherd song, the Corsican traditional song. So we latched on to that quite early, and it was a question of trying to run with that and incorporate it into the score and make that work. Yeah, really good at giving me just a key steers at key moments. But I mean, again, you know, a huge machine working, so many stuff, so much going on. Just, you know, you see that film, you just see the amount of energy and creativity gone into every single shot there. So, yeah, it was quite a thing.
Extremes of it, isn't it? Because there's those extraordinary battle scenes, like, and so many of them as well within the show. But then those kind of intimate scenes, you know, whether it's the crawling across the table or of, you know, the sort of that relationship and that character as well, and those performances, particularly Vanessa and Joaquin Phoenix. Just, I mean, you know, it's interesting speaking to composers for the show in terms of when people come on board and whether they're writing to script or whether they're writing to performance for Joker, and Joaquin being given Hilda's score, elements of Hilda's score whilst shooting, and it really informing part of that performance as well. So how did it work with Napoleon?
Yeah, I came on just as they were starting filming, so I didn't really get going until they, you know, their shoot was sort of nearing the end. And again, Ridley and I also worked closely with the editors. They gave me some sort of quite clear steers, and it was just like, go away and write some stuff. You know, again, I wasn't really writing to picture. And, you know, if you're coming on at that stage, it's not a good idea to start trying to write to picture too much, because you know, everything is going to change. And yeah, the thing about The Crown is that it really, you know, I was lucky enough to come on to something that already knew really what it was. And with a big film, historical film like that, you know, it may take time to find its tone, you know, to settle down to what it's trying to be. So, and I think, you know, and I did with the music as well, it took me a while to find the right tone that everyone was happy with. You know, it was really about being and that's why I think really so clever, is it being a little unexpected with a historical drama like that. And quite a lot of the stuff I wrote, you know, it wasn't classic battle music. It wasn't classic period drama music. It was often trying to do something, maybe quite small, quite intimate, you know, even in this huge story, and to do the battle slightly differently. I was really keen to not just have hammering drums and strings. Yeah. Trying to incorporate the Corsican music into that really helped and gave us a different angle on it.
Is that part of the sort of starting block then, when you have those discussions about that being a real kind of influence to the sound, then you've got to go and kind of research that, and you've got to go and kind of... you know, educate yourself further, you know, into what that is. Is that part, do you enjoy that part of the job of kind of, you know, it's you constantly learning about different different things, I imagine, as well. Exactly.
And that's a real joy. I mean, that's, you know, I love listening to music. And this gives you a narrative and a direction in which to really get immersed in. But it's a very, you know, my job's a very solitary job. It's, you know, I've got, you know, people to help me, but in the end, I sort of have to be on my own. So I spend hours just sitting in my studio listening to music, which is what a joy that is. And particularly the Corsican stuff, you know, trailing through loads of Corsican tracks and different types of singers and then trying to source the singers and find who was going to do it for us and, you know, bringing them over and recording them, you know, which was a very tricky thing because the thing about Corsican singing, it's all about basically it's guys in a room singing with each other. They don't like to be singing. They're not singing to anything else. They've got no instrument. Okay. They don't have. Or they might have, but it's all about them and the harmonies that they create and the overtones, and they lean right into each other and just sort of kind of bounce off each other in the sound that they get. But consequently, if you're trying to incorporate them into a soundtrack, you know, it's really hard. They I just about persuaded them to have a click track in their ear so they could at least be in time with what I'd written, but no pitch.
That was it.
I didn't even have a note on a piano to start with, so the pitching was all over the place. And that's part of the beauty of it was that it almost feels like it's about to fall apart and nearly out of tune and horrible, but it doesn't quite. That kind of little in-between space is really interesting music. I love that kind of, it's all slightly out of tune, but it's not. It's acceptable to our ear and it's got a beauty of it in its own right.
About that tradition being passed down as well, you know, in terms of for how many hundred years has that been something that's been part of kind of Corsican culture?
Exactly.
And how do you become part of that? And at what age do you, you know, and when do you pass it on and walk away and all that? It's like, it's lovely.
Yeah, yeah. And they're totally steeped in it. And yet they may probably can't even read music. So always we would understand it. So it's like, it's really, you're entering a very different world and a whole tradition.
Someone needs to make a documentary about Corsican singers. That's
if you ever want to, Edith, I know a great guy.
What is next, you know, in terms of, you know, making the choices on what you want to do as a creative and learn and challenge yourself as you continue through your career and stuff? What's informing your choices?
It's quite simple. It's just kind of stuff that I might watch myself, you know, and you don't know early on in the process how something's going to turn out. But if it's like, oh yeah, I'd watch that and that interests me. And then obviously it's the people involved in it and their history and what you've done. And if I've worked with them and if they're nice people, that's also really good.
Yeah. You want to have a nice time, don't you?
Really nice.
That's not always the case, but you want to have a nice time.
No. But primarily people who've got a vision and feel like they're confident in being able to say that. Because again, if making film and TV is so hard, pull anything off. I've got such admiration for anyone who can make anything and make it really well. You've got to have a real vision about what you're trying to do. And really, I just want to be, you know, I want to be near those people because it's a great joy to be part of that vision, you know, to be inspired by their vision. It really helps me write music and get inspired by if they're really keen and I've got something clear to say.
Was there a particular character or relationship that you enjoyed writing for the most on The Crown?
Good question. I mean, I loved writing Josh O'Connor's Charles in 3 and 4. He was always... I mean, I just loved watching him, you know, whilst hearing him, you know, that was absolutely, absolutely gorgeous. Mm-hmm. there were some moments with Olivia Colman as the Queen, the whole solo horn thing, her walk round Aberfan in all that was incredibly challenging to score on sort of lots of different levels, but it was so rewarding in the end, and I found that scene so affecting and really great to be a part of. Both Dianas were just brilliant, and both Dianas, yeah, you know what I mean.
Yeah, totally. But it's also interesting to think about that you were fed different things from the different actors who played the roles in a way as well, yeah. You know.
I mean, again, that's the sort of odd thing is when by the time it gets to me, it looks so effortless what they've done and the tone they've created and the characters they've made. And, you know, it won't have been. It'll been, you know, they'll have gone through the same struggle that I do later when I'm sitting trying to hit that tone right. And I think that's what The Crown was so good at, was it kept going until it found the right tone. You know, that all the characters, God, they were all fantastic. Jonathan Pryce. I mean, there were some really chilling moments, clever moments with him of where he would, talking about suppressed power, where he would seem like this benign, avuncular figure and then suddenly turn and be really, really chilling.
Yeah, terrifying.
Same with Tobias Menzies. I mean, who was absolutely great, and I loved some of his episodes.
Yeah, the moon landing and the moon whole kind of story with his mum. That was
mother daughter thing with him and his mother and what he was trying, and his relationship with Charles. Great moment where the night before the funeral of
Mountbatten.
Yes, thank you. Funeral of Mountbatten. And the night before, and Josh O'Connor comes back to see his father, Tobias Menzies, as Prince Philip, and he's drunk and he's aggressive but trying to be nice, and it's just such a fantastically written, acted scene.
There's so much.
Yeah, I could go
so
on.
Much. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. One last question before we go. Is there a score for you that was either a kind of big inspiration for, you know, this wanting to be your world, or a score that you go back to again and again and again?
Totally. I can completely identify the moment for me that got me in, made me realize that writing music for film and TV was something really incredible was seeing Michael Nyman's score for The Draftsman's Contract. You know, and that can age me. So I think I was probably about 15 and I didn't even see it in the cinema. I saw it on telly, and I remember there was a scene, it's called Shepherds Chasing Sheep or something, and this mad rock and roll sort of punk rock classical music came out, and I was just open mouthed. My God, I'd never heard score like it, and it felt incredibly modern, and although I had quite a classical upbringing, I was always really drawn to commercial music and tracks and not, you know, wanted to move away from classical, but then the fusion of the two was just electrifying. And also the way it was mused. I mean, usually up to that point, score was very orchestral. It was very often very background. And, you know, and I had huge respect for John Williams' Star Wars, which was, again, a real eye-opener. But actually, what I really connected to was this three-chord, four-chord repetitive stuff. It's very simple, very clear. Although I don't really write music like Michael Nyman, there was a clarity in it and a simple drive to it, which I absolutely love.
That's lovely, because that's a a combination of a lovely story from you, but also a really great recommendation for people if they haven't seen the film as well. So
yeah,
that's a double whammy for sure.
Absolutely, check that out. Yeah.
Amazing. Great to catch up with you. I'm really excited to see what. Do you know what's next, or are you?
Yeah, I do. I'm working on a Netflix spy series with Keira Knightley and Ben Whishaw.
Oh, wicked!
It's really fun. It's kind of a little bit Mr. and Mrs. Smithy. I don't know if you've seen the Amazon series.
Yeah, with Donald Glover.
It's a very English version of that. It's really good. And just going back to your previous question, why, you know, what I'm doing, it was just so nice to do something completely different and do some genre. And no French horns will be employed in the making. So
I've got an 11-year-old who's on grade 4 at the minute, so he's coming through on the French horn. Yeah, he loves it. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, available when you need him for the future.
When we
French
do the,
horn.
When we do the Crown.
Part two, or the prequel.
Prequel, maybe, I don't know.
Whatever. That's the funny thing about getting going round to Peter's house to do those interviews for the podcast. We built up a trust after the first couple where there was an element of proving ourselves in terms of what we were going to do whilst we were there. Yeah. But then it was just really, there was maybe 3 or 4 of us would go round to record in his house. And we just felt such a treat to be invited into his house. But I'd always be looking at his coffee table. Yeah. To see what books he was reading, to try and get a steer on what he might be writing next.
Yeah, he's did some really interesting stuff coming up. So, but quite different, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. Let's lovely chat to you. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
See you again. I hope I get to see you again sometime.
Yeah, I hope so too. Maybe we can do something for the new Netflix show for sure.
Yeah, that'll be really fun. It's out on, it's coming out for Christmas. It's out before Christmas.
Perfect. Yeah, perfect. Yeah. What a lovely gift.
Brilliant.
All right, Martin. Thanks so much. Take care.
Bye. Bye.
From the score to the last season of The Crown, that's Orders and Customs, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrack with the wonderful Martin Phipps. My huge thanks to Martin for taking the time to talk to me. The Crown is, of course, available to watch in its entirety on Netflix, whilst you can watch Napoleon on Apple TV. As I mentioned, the accompanying podcast to The Crown is available in all the usual places, hosted by yours truly. And also good luck to all Team Crown at the upcoming Emmys. Head to edithbowman.com to find every single episode of Soundtrackin', and do follow us on our socials. We're Soundtrackin' UK. Our YouTube channel is called Soundtrackin' Extra, so it would be wonderful if you could subscribe to that too. Next up, really excited to have Zoe Kravitz and producers Tiffany Parsons and Garrett Levitz joining me to discuss Blink Twice. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.